Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week around our kitchen table in the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames in the old Pantorium building. You can find us here on Douglas Avenue. We are Community Radio, and that means they let us on the air once a week to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. Welcome to our show, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Thanks to them, and thanks to you, our listener. Well, this past weekend, here it is, September in Iowa. I had a good time. I went to Winterset, Iowa on Saturday night. There's an organization called Ag Arts, Agriculture Arts, very good combination. And they organized a concert from a pair of musicians that came all the way from Ireland. They were interested in Iowa, and we were interested in them, a button box player and a dandy flute player. They were so good. They were so good. And they were in the Iowa Theater right off the square there in Winterset, Iowa. The Iowa Theater is a restored, I think it's an old vaudeville house.
Oh, a building.
A building. A building.
In Winterset. In downtown
Winterset. All
right.
It's just a gem of a place. The Connemara lads, they played there, and we had a good time.
Well, and the backstory with the Ag Arts is Mary Swander, the Iowa Poet Laureate, who is the founder of Ag Arts, has set up this exchange where foreigners, mostly Irish, because at this point she goes to Ireland a lot and is well-beloved there. She brings artists from other countries for a farm stay in Iowa. So this is the second year of this program. And so apparently the Connemara lads were on a farm in Iowa for a month.
They were actually artists in residence. They wrote some music. And they did a wonderful job. And it was nice.
So they came for the Iowa experience.
They did. So keep your eyes open for Ag Arts. Yes, you can.
Right. There is a Facebook page, Ag Arts.
So everybody's talking about mosquitoes around here and hurricanes. Now, we don't have hurricanes, but we have mosquitoes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well,
a fine crop of mosquitoes we're producing this year.
Oh, my gosh. So you meet the nicest people at potlucks, mosquitoes or no mosquitoes. I met this wonderful man a while ago at a potluck where you meet the nicest people. And he had amid the great Iowa potluck spread there. There were these jars of colors and interesting looking things. They were cordials. And I tasted all of them and they were lovely. There was
cordials as in alcoholic.
Yeah.
Or if they start out, they're not quite so alcoholic, but the start of it. And there were the flavors. Black raspberry. There was milkweed, elderberry flower, spiderwort. Can you imagine? And they all
spiderwort.
Yes. So very good. So, Ben Hawk is here in our studio. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and on the show.
Good. I found out that besides making these things that are pretty, I always respond to things that are pretty. They taste good. And he forages. He knows what's out there. He knows there's a bounty to be harvested. So tell us a little bit about you, Ben, and what you do.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Johnston, Iowa, and spent my college years at the University of Northern Iowa up in Cedar Falls, kind of cutting my teeth on the tall grass prairie and, you know, Iowa's agro ecosystems. And, you know, just took a great interest in the bounty that Iowa produces, both in the crops that we have, but also our wild foods.
What's left of it, there are still some things
There are, and the little pieces that are so left are so beautiful and unique that it makes you appreciate them all the more.
Oh, boy. So yes. You are a trained biologist.
I am, yep. I've been called worse. but, yeah, I spend my time now kind of picking up contract work here and there and working for some folks in the area, kind of doing butterfly surveys or plant surveys. And
that's what you're doing back here in Iowa now.
Yeah, so I took a summer job working out at Camp Dodge Military Base. I like to tell people at potlucks that I'm a contractor for the Department of Defense, and then they kind of look at me a little bit.
And they're counting butterflies in the Department of Defense, right?
Yes, I am. So
well, this is part of our national strategy, I hope.
Yeah, well, military bases are great. They've got all kinds of wild land for the bases to do their military drills on. And along with that comes all kinds of really great wildlife resources. So they manage them really well. So they got us as a team out there from Tufts University. They hired me on as a local boy. And we are studying monarch butterflies, which are definitely a hot topic these days.
Yes, it is. They're kind of the species that most people can identify them. And
it used to be save the spotted owls. Now it's save the monarch butterflies.
That's a good idea. Yeah. And really, they are, I used to see a lot more. They are sort of in trouble or not?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Iowa is the most altered landscape in the nation, and we have a responsibility to look after the critters that live here, especially with monarchs. This is kind of the center of their breeding range for the summer. So we're working on a little project that's studying parasite transfer from adults to caterpillars and tracking adults, and actually just picked up some little monarch watch tags to see if any of the ones that we're rearing or catching wild are going to make it down to Mexico. So it's been a lot of fun this summer.
So you're gonna put little tags on monarchs?
Yeah, we got little stickers we put on them. And then even better, we've got like 10 different colors of gel pens. And so we don't recapture the same butterfly. We give them like a pink, purple, blue, orange little combo colors. So the ones that are flying down south have got stickers and gel pen. They're ready for the big party down in Mexico.
Where do you put gel pen? What is that?
So it's, you know, like a sixth grade girl writing in her diary kind of deal, you know.
What do? Mark the wings?
Or? Yeah, you grab them and they've got a forewing and a hind wing. If you look at them, they've got two on each side.
And it doesn't damage the wing?
Well, no, you just do it really softly and hold on to them really nicely.
This is a very intricate thing for the Department of Defense.
Hey,
subtlety, we're into this. Go for it. All right.
So, yeah, you know, when I'm not catching butterflies, you know, I'm roaming around Iowa's wild places and getting to know the food that I can encounter, you know, whether it be wild mushrooms or flowers, edible plants, roots, shoots, and bulbs. And
did you do this as a kid too? Is this a natural inclination?
Yeah. So, okay. Do you remember the first wild food that you ever ate or the first thing that could be considered wild, you know, way back in the memory? So mine, I remember I was working in the front yard or not working. I was probably 5 years old. There was a guy on a lawnmower who was buzzing the city land right next to us. And for some reason, he got off of his lawnmower and was like, hey, little dude, did you know you can eat this little yellow flower that's growing in the fence row?
Is it chamomile?
Well, I'm thinking
that's what mine was.
Okay, nice. I'm thinking mine was wood sorrel or oxalis.
Oh, yes.
Sourgrass.
Sour flower.
There we go.
All
yeah.
right.
So I got that memory from being such a little kid and having this person be like, check it out right in front of you. So it's kind of been something that stuck with me.
Oh, very good. And so what are you finding currently to eat?
Well, fall is a real big time for mushrooms. That's what I've been getting into lately. We had a nice little rain spell
Came
today.
Came right with the mosquitoes, didn't it?
Yeah, they were pretty brutal today in the field.
Well, if you didn't get the rain, you wouldn't get the mushrooms, you know. I guess they would say the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh, right? Mosquitoes for mushrooms. What are you going to do?
That's a pretty good trade in my book, yeah. So, yeah, I've been running after our big fall, like kind of some of the flashy ones. So you've
got the
chicken of the woods is probably the easiest one to identify. Imagine a big, bright orange shelf fungi that grows kind of like a big exploding coral on the side of a tree. Actually, I found about 50 pounds on Friday on one tree. Amazing, from just toe to head. You had to get a ladder to get the rest of it.
Oh, neat. And if you catch them at the right time, they're lovely. If you wait till they get a little hard, they're not so good.
No. I really like to take them and marinate them overnight in maybe some soy sauce and ginger and maybe some fish sauce, a little bit of salt, and then grill them, and they're just spectacular.
Oh, chicken in the woods, how nice.
50 pounds.
It's a lot,
you
yeah.
You had a big cookout, I guess, huh?
Yeah, well, I got some friends in the restaurant industry, and they love that kind of stuff, too. So, you know,
good.
Whatever you can do.
If you can find a market for that, boy, oh, boy, walk it in the back end of a restaurant, and some chefs will just light up.
Yeah.
Very good for you. And so... what are the kind of mushrooms besides chicken of the woods?
I say the next two big ones are probably hen of the woods, uh-huh. Which grows at the base of oak trees. And it kind of looks like a ruffled up kind of gray-brown hen, you know. And it's got little white pore surface below, kind of gray up top. And they start mm-hmm. off really, really small. And over the period of about 5 to 7 days, they can blow up to be huge. I think the record that was found was 103 pounds.
No.
Yes. Wheelbarrow and four people to pick it up. I saw some photos.
In Iowa?
No, this was in Maine, if I remember right. I got a little stint out there. I found one this year that was 13 pounds, which was a pretty nice one. That was about a week ago. And after these rains this week, I think they're gonna keep on jumping out of the ground.
Very good. Oh, here's a little aside. How do you deal with the mosquitoes when you're out there?
The key to finding mushrooms is covering a lot of ground.
Yeah.
So the more ground you cover, the faster you move, the more mushrooms you find most of the time if you're looking for bigger ones. Yeah. And if you just move fast enough, they'll keep up with you.
Oh, you move fast. Bless your heart.
Long sleeves, long pants, and I tend to find if you wear like a wide-brimmed hat, they get kind of confused about, you know, where to land on you. So,
very good.
You know.
Very good. Very good. So you gather things, and you also know how to deal with them, what to do with them. You have got a whole bunch of show and tell or show and smell here. So let's...
Show and taste.
Show and taste. What else do you have for us here? What else did you find out there?
Well, I've got a little flight of... they started off as cordials. I'm working on my definitions here.
Cordial.
They kind of start off as a cordial, which is like a carbonated flower or fruit beverage.
Mm-hmm.
After that, they turn into a wine. And then after that, they'll turn into a vinegar. And, you know, that process goes. I've got a little recipe here. It's kind of easy to follow. You take 2 quarts of water, 2 cups of sugar, 2 tablespoons of live vinegar, and you can use apple cider vinegar, Bragg's organic, you know, with the mother is a good one to start off with.
Right. Be sure to... The vinegar has to be alive. So Bragg's is readily available around town and probably the best pick if you want to grow.
That's a good one. You can also just take a bottle of wine and leave it out on the counter for about a month and let all the flies die in there and then wait for that little jelly to form on top, strain them out, and then you've got your own homemade vinegar. But,
there you go.
You know, not for the – it's only for the brave, but, you know, everyone should try it once.
It takes time.
It does. Yeah, if you want to do it right away,
just go buy some Bragg's.
Oh, yep. So back up and do the cordial recipe.
Okay.
So after the 2 tablespoons of vinegar, live vinegar, you use 2 cups of flowers or fruit. And then 2 whole lemons. Mm-hmm. And you let that stuff sit. And I like to use a half-gallon mason jar. And you can let it sit in the sun for
a
day.
What's the point? Explain the lemon part. I don't know about.
The lemons add some nice acidity to it. And it kind of helps out with the ferment a little bit. The way that I learned is...
you don't cut them in half?
Cut them in half.
You said
juice
whole.
Them.
Come on.
Yeah.
Get this recipe so we can...
Right.
I'm going to go home and try it.
Cut them down the middle.
The whole lemon sitting in the jar going, now what the hell are
good call,
you
going
to do? Yeah.
Cut them down the middle, squeeze them out, and then just throw the whole things in there. Let them hang out.
Oh, squeeze them out and then throw the whole thing in.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Try to make it easy for us.
Okay.
And then after that, you know, you let it sit for a day or two, and then you strain off the lemons and the flowers, because sometimes if you let some of that stuff sit in there for too long, it can add some bitterness or mm-hmm, off flavors. Mm-hmm. And you can experiment with that. Some stuff, like if you use cherries, the pits from the cherries give a nice kind of... almonds extract flavor that you can let them hang out for a little longer, but it's all an experiment. So,
So are the jars in the refrigerator, on your counter, covered, uncovered?
On your counter, and I like to cover them, just loosely cover them with a regular mason jar lid. Because when you put in the flowers or the fruit, they've got some natural yeast that hang out on the outside of them. I don't boil any of it or, you know, freeze it, you know, so those live yeast will kind of come to life with those sugars.
Wild yeast.
Ooh,
love the wild ones.
It can get scary sometimes, but, you know, some stuff works really well. It'll go all the way from a carbonated beverage to a wine. Sometimes they won't turn to vinegar. Sometimes they won't turn to wines. You know, it kind of depends on the makeup of the flower.
Probably depends on the position of the moon and sun, too.
I wouldn't doubt it.
I wouldn't. So explain what you got here. The colors of this stuff are just wonderful. That he's got some jars of cordial.
Yeah, well, we're on the topic of monarchs, so I guess I'll go to this one, milkweed.
How does it get pink? It's pink, guys.
It's pink.
Milkweed flowers.
Yeah.
So basically the whole milkweed plant is edible. It's a common misconception that the plant is not. I'm referencing common milkweed here. So early in the spring, you can harvest the shoots. Careful not to confuse them with dog bane. There's a couple little similarities
there.
That's right. Now, is this the milkweed that we've all been planting to feed the monarch?
This is, yep.
Okay. I have some in my garden then.
So they've got a little bit of competition, but the nice thing about those monarchs is they show up all summer. And if you do a little bit of harvesting, that new fresh growth is actually some of the best stuff for the caterpillars to munch on. So, you know, you can help out every single generation as they're coming through if you harvest just a little bit. So I take 2 cups of those flowers when they're in full bloom. You got to be careful to shake off the little soldier beetles and the bumblebees and all the little critters hiding in there. And, throw them in that recipe and let them sit for a day or two, strain them out, and it makes just a really, really nice cordial. So this one is
probably – we're going to taste it. Oh,
it's probably gotten to the wine stage. Now, as I was saying before, some of this stuff is a really good cordial, an okay wine, and a really good vinegar. You know, so I haven't tried this one in – well, it's been in my friend's basement for about 2 months now.
I was going to say, when you let them sit, you kind of put them not in the sunshine, basically.
Well, I like to put them in the sun for the first day or so. That'll really wake up those yeasts and get them going really quickly.
Woohoo!
Is it started to turn to vinegar yet?
No.
It's not exactly vinegar, but it's potent.
It's on its way to wine and... It looks like it's such a soft, wonderful pink, and it's got
so
a kick.
So this had sugar. The sweetness is gone.
Yep.
We're passing this around.
So that's the neat thing with these vinegars too. When you make a wine, the yeast in there turns the sugar into alcohol, and then the vinegar bacteria goes ahead and turns the alcohol into vinegar, and it'll kind of stabilize.
It's interesting.
At that point.
It's sort of.
Let me get a little taste.
Well, picture that on some ice or maybe with a little soda water with
it. It's alcohol-y.
I'm thinking.
The yeast. Especially in the back of the mouth. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And when we tried
this
as a cordial.
No worse than homemade moonshine.
When we tried this as a cordial, you know, it didn't have that bite to it.
It's not sweet.
It was really nice and really sweet and really floral. And I'm thinking that this one's going to be a really good vinegar. You know, it may not be one that settles as a wine all too well. But that's just part of the fun of experimenting with it.
Oh, it's nice to have something alive and changing. Look at that.
Yeah.
Oh, pick another color. You've got some more lovely colors here.
Yeah,
lovely jars of cordials that are on their way to greater things.
That definitely looks like pink lemonade.
Doesn't
it? It's that kind of color.
So I've got another one here, which I believe this one already has a little vinegar mother growing in it.
Okay, this one is purple.
This one is bright purple. So this is spiderwort. This is one of our two native species of spiderwort. They are a kind of late spring, early summer, prairie, savanna plant. And the flowers only bloom for about 1 day, and they only bloom in the morning.
Whoa.
So you got to get there first thing in the morning to pick your 2 cups. And I'm telling you, this is like fluorescent Barney purple.
It is
one of the most pleasing to the eyes cordials I've ever gotten a chance to try.
That is a good description of a purple, Barney purple.
I think it's going to have a little vinegar bite to it, and I think it's going to even just get better with time.
Spiderwort.
It's not terribly vinegary.
Not yet.
It's more like shrubby.
Okay.
So great.
The shrub being the old name for an extraction, vinegar. It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, what a nice
thing. I'm excited about
that
one.
And so how old is this one?
I think I harvested this one in July. So it's still pretty sweet compared I did that milkweed one a little bit later than that even. So it's kind of just a good example.
Right,
of,
the milkweed one has no sweetness left in it at all.
Oh, yum. Yum.
This is very...
Yeah, I enjoy that.
And did it turn purple right away?
Oh, yeah. It took like 24 hours.
So just sucks it right out of the flower then.
It's beautiful, yeah.
But what color are the flowers?
The flowers aren't nearly as fluorescent as this. They're more of like a
bluish. Bluish.
Yeah, bluish purple.
Okay.
And yeah, you never quite know what you're going to get.
See,
so there's...
You need someone... Well, go out and get to know your outdoors and find these things. But I see spiderwort, but I never see like 2 gallons worth of.
Two cups
worth of. You know, to pick that many flowers, you have to know where to look.
Yeah,
good for you.
You do, or you can start yourself a little prairie, and you can
very
have
good.
It in your own
grow
backyard.
Your own.
Very good.
Very.
What else you got here?
So we got another one coming up.
But I have a quick question.
Oh yeah,
Do we know if? Does spiderwort have any medicinal qualities? Because lots of times this way of preservation, people made medicines out of them.
Right. Yeah. So I dabble with medicinal plants superficially. You know, I wouldn't call myself an herbalist, but I try to keep up on the common ones. As for spiderwort, I'm not too familiar with many of the medicinal uses. I know the plant itself is entirely edible. It is kind of mucilaginous if you want to get after it.
Oh, okay. So it probably has some uses and qualities.
Yeah. I've also heard that it can cause a little bit of contact dermatitis in some people. So I got a friend who was trying to weed it out of her garden, and she kept thinking she got poison ivy. And I've heard it with a couple other seed producers, too. But
spiderwort.
Don't fear it. It's a nice plant.
Yeah. I want to take this opportunity to say that this is KHOI 89.1, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We'll be back with more good things to taste with Ben Hoch. And this is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a little music from an Irish band called Solas. I really like the band called Solas. I don't even know if they're still together, but all the musicians are still around. That was a tune, well, the first tune for sure, was called The Flowing Bowl. And considering we're talking about gathering today and foraging, we're here around the kitchen table with Ben Hoch, and we're talking about cordials. He's got so many nice things to taste. What have you got for us again?
We've got one more on the plate here. It's a
Oh my goodness! The cork just blew up and hit the ceiling like a classic champagne.
You are a wonderful guest, Ben.
Too bad we don't have a live feed going here. That would have been a good one. So we've got a black raspberry cordial here.
Okay, this one is like a cranberry colored.
And it has turned past the cordial stage. It's onto the wine.
It's got that alcohol thing going.
And it's got a bite. And
It is drinkable. I have had homemade wines that you really don't want to drink.
This is interesting. It's good.
And I think this is another one of those, like some, you know, with this recipe, which is a recipe I always follow for my cordials, you know, some turn out as a good wine, some don't, but you wait for them to turn to a vinegar if they're not a good wine. And that's the nice thing about
it.
I
think what you're doing here that I find helpful, and this is, I'm going to say, you know, since I'm an adventurous taster, I've tasted a lot of things, but I am not an expert on this. But I find that when people are making homemade alcohol, this is just my experience, if you're using wild yeasts, something always happens that you can still drink. Whereas if I've seen people who, you know, they go to the brew store, they buy the yeast, and then somehow, even though it's more predictable, it still ends up having a sort of fairly yeasty flavor that when you're using wild yeasts, even though you can't predict what you're going to get, it is also, it's always a little more palatable than when you actually buy the stuff at the brewer store. Ah. So I'm a big fan of wild yeast. I mean, I know people don't like it because it's unpredictable. Okay, wait. So well, now what am I drinking? This is the thing that popped the cork, right?
This is actually moving into meads. This is a wild plum mead that I made, and it's probably 4 years old now. This is one of those bottles I gave to a friend, and I thought the whole batch was gone and drank.
So this is not this recipe.
No, this is not. This is a completely different recipe.
Taste this one, Lana.
So this one disappeared for about 4 years, and I was re-gifted an unopened bottle of my own mead from years ago.
No wonder it blew the top off.
Oh, nice. So define mead. I've heard of mead, but I don't know if I've ever tasted. Tell us about mead, Ben.
Okay, so the general recipe for mead is the original recipe is just basically honey and water. And you've got those two things, a little bit of live yeast hanging out in the honey or in the open air, and you've got mead.
It was probably one of the earliest forms of fermented anything.
That is correct. Now, what I like to do with them is this is where it gets into all of the funky names that are associated. You know, we have to give a name to every little thing that we do. So if you make a mead with grapes, it's called a piment. If you make...
Spell that.
P-I-M-E-N-T. It's not a wine,
a
even though it has
grapes.
A mead
with grapes. So it's honey and grapes?
Honey and grapes and water. Huh. If you do a mead with flowers, that is called a melomel. M-E-L-O-M-E-L.
Okay.
I've heard of that. I think probably in a fantasy story, fairies and that sort of thing. Melomel.
So yes. That would be a wild plum melomel. Now, it may actually
so this
have...
So with the plums or with the flowers?
This is with the plum fruit.
The plum fruit. Yeah, how would you describe this color? It's a little brownish pinky. Slightly more cloudy than the other ones.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways to go about making your meads. If you heat fruits that are high in pectin, you get a little bit of a haze going on. So I've been experimenting lately with just freezing my fruits and then using them in the meads that way. You don't end up with that haze. But the nice thing about
Wait, why do you freeze them?
Because you don't have to... process them with heat afterwards. You know, it'll kill some of the yeast on there. And
so you're controlling the wild yeast.
Trying to control it a little bit.
Okay,
yep.
Okay.
So, because when I make my meads, I do them in like 5 or 6 or 7 gallon batches. So I actually use, you know, a yeast that you buy from the store. It's a D47. You know, it's really good at breaking down honey.
It had a yeast in it.
Correct. It had a yeast I introduced. Mm-hmm. Now, the nice thing with those cordials is that you're only doing a half gallon at a time. So if something doesn't taste too good as a wine, you can turn it into a vinegar really quick, and that's all right. But I've been doing the meads for like 7 or 8 years now, and if I'm harvesting 5 gallons of plums or autumn olives or nanny berries, you know, I want to try to have a little
more
control.
Yeah, they're kind of precious. It's a lot of work.
Oh, yeah. So how much – okay, these are meads that are flavored with wild gathered things. How much honey goes into a 5 gallon batch?
Right. What's the honey to water ratio? How do we do that?
So it kind of depends on the sugar content that you want, how high your alcohol content is. But generally speaking, I keep them at about 13%. That's when the yeast that I use.
13% what?
13% alcohol.
Is what you're going. But to get that, how much honey
Oh, yeah.
To water. What's the ratio?
So it's about 5 gallons of water to 1 gallon of honey, which is about 12 pounds.
Okay.
And I'll also introduce about 20 to 25 pounds of wild fruit in there.
Ooh,
so that's a nice addition. Adds a little bit of water, you know. And the reason I moved into meads, I started off with wines. And these cordials are nice because, you know, sugar is readily accessible and pretty cheap. But I figured if I was going to be making things on a big scale, you know, why not go as local as possible? So contact local honey producers, you know, get some nice raw stuff. This is a great time of year.
Oh, yes.
People
raw
are pulling
honey,
their
that's
supers.
Really important.
It's a good way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Good. And this is honey that's already been spun and cleaned up. It's not the comb.
Nope. It's extracted honey.
But it's raw unheated, right?
Yep. It is. The 5 gallon batch I bought this year definitely was. Got them from a fella with the Friendly Beekeepers of Iowa organization, which is a great resource for beginning and experienced beekeepers. They've got classes they offer once a month. And just a wealth of knowledge. You know, when I first moved back here this summer, I bought a fella out of his beekeeping supplies and just had no idea what I was doing. And one little message on the Facebook group, and 2 days later, I had a guy out to my house walking me through the ropes. So it's
very good.
It's a great deal.
And so you've just begun trying to keep bees yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of, you know, I learn about being a biologist, and then I'm looking at things I can eat, and then, okay, how can I preserve these? Oh, I can make some wine. Oh, maybe if I get into mead, you know, I got the honey going. Oh, now I got that figured out. I need to make my own honey. You know, it's kind of one of those wormholes.
Oh, beekeeping is enormously
spin
fun.
Down,
absolutely.
You know?
I have to say, when I was in California, I had a hive in my backyard because my neighbor was a beekeeper. So when he did the spinning, I went and helped him, and it was like, I have to say, it was a godly experience. Really, there was something you see when you talk about the land of milk and honey. When you're spinning the honey, and a lot of it gets in the air because you're kind of sticky all over, but there's something that happens that you get ecstatic. I mean, it's just a beautiful, beautiful experience. I'm sorry. I was not on any alcohol or drugs at the time. It's just a phenomenal thing, and anybody who gets a bee in their bonnet to try it, go for it.
Oh. Well, they're just up to so much work this summer, and to have the concentrated nectar of, you know, summer that's accessible anytime is just...
And each one, every honey tastes differently.
Yes. Yeah.
And yeah, we'll get into that too. So when I make my meads, I use a combination of two different types of honey. So I use a regular clover honey for the bulk of the sweetness that I add, the food for the yeast. And then I also use a really dark buckwheat honey.
Which we have here in Iowa.
We do.
Ooh.
Buckwheat honey is basically the color of sorghum or molasses. It's got a really great, rich, barnyardy, you know, just walked outside, you know, in the heat of the summer kind of smell. And it's super high in nutrients.
Absolutely. I get my buckwheat honey from Earl Hafner at Early Morning Harvest. Earl swears that he eats a tablespoon a day and it cures his arthritis.
I wouldn't doubt it.
There you go.
Spectacular. So it's really good for the yeast, too. So a lot of recipes call for a yeast nutrient. And, you know, any way when I can make a mead, you know, out of foraged ingredients and wild and honey, you know, I want to try to avoid buying as many little packets of things as possible. So if I can add buckwheat honey and get the nitrogen and the phosphorus and those things that the yeast really need to be happy, you know, why can't I, you know, support a local producer and add some nice flavor into the mix?
Well, buckwheat honey, and like I just tasted your buckwheat honey, which is a little different from Earl's. I mean, on a slight spectrum, because buckwheat honey is a very distinct flavor. Some people, if you're expecting it to taste like honey, you get a little put off. But if you're going into this as a flavor distinct on its own in the universe,
it is
remarkable.
Oh, yes, no doubt. You know, it almost reminds me of the flavor of some of these little nanny berries here.
Oh, now, a nanny berry? All right, here's...
So there's a big seed in the middle there, and this
have
is
have you
the...
ever had a nanny berry?
I have never had
me
any.
Either.
Are these native
what do they
to
grow
Iowa?
On?
They are native to Iowa. They're,
is it a shrub?
It is a shrub. They can get maybe 10 to 15 feet tall, really big ones. There's a big seed on the inside.
A flat seed. You bite the fruit off of it, and it's kind of like a watermelon seed on the inside.
It looks like a watermelon... But it tastes persimmony.
Yeah, like I've also heard it described like pruney or like raisin-like, you know.
No, persimmons.
Persimmons. All right, nice. New one to add to the description.
Mm.
So they're cool. They're they're a fruit
they're
that's
delicious.
Ripening up now, and they're definitely a native to Iowa. I usually find them in kind of
dark purple. Okay.
Like riparian areas, you know, kind of swales. They're kind of rare in the state anymore. I don't encounter them much, but I did find a nice little population out at the Chautauqua Bottoms. If anyone is wandering around out there, you may run into them.
They're small little dark berries. I mean, I don't know how you would identify them if you didn't have some kind of field guide or something.
Yeah, you know,
well, remarkable. Or you get a degree in botany. Follow Ben.
That's right. I am off to you and I to learn from Laura and Conrad. These are amazing.
I think the Latin on them is they're a viburnum, which is a really common shrub. You know, you may even have them grown in your front yard or around a building as a landscaping.
I do.
You know.
But when
viburnum
so
lentago
they get
is, I believe,
berries
the name.
This time of year?
They do. You know, you got to beat the birds to them. But I was harvesting these about 2 weeks ago, and there were still some that were ripening up for sure. The flies really love them as well, so you kind of got to get there at the right time or just not be afraid of flies.
Yeah, very good. Yum.
I've got one more over here. That's this is called Autumn Olive, or the Autumn Berry. It is a, you could call it a noxious weed.
They look kind of like currants, don't they?
It's a nice little tart shrub that grows about 10 to 15 feet tall as well. And they've got nice little red, orange, kind of white speckled
fruits on
them.
Are they related to currants?
I don't believe so. I believe they may actually be related to olives, but I'm not exactly sure on that one. So,
Autumn olive is planted as a wildlife planting, or even in your yard. I have some autumn olives. Yeah,
they could be related to olives because they have at the end of the flavor when it's in your mouth and you're crunching on them. An uncured olive has that sort of what do you call it?
Tannin?
Yeah, it's a tannin.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Super high in tannins, yeah.
Just and that, I can associate that with olives.
And so you use your autumn olives also in making meats?
Yeah, so I've been kind of hitting some of the wild fruits really hard this year, things that I haven't found before, and I've been freezing up, you know, stockpiling stuff to try some new ones. So I've got elderberry going this year. I've got dandelion. I've got... Oh, shoot, I got the wild plum. You know, yeah, just kind of seeing how many I can put together. And
oh, it's so nice to know someone who knows that all that stuff is out there. And also, not just knowing that it's out there, but knowing what to do with it. We'll be back with more of Ben in a little bit. This is KHOI. Find out more about the Dunalana Kitchen and this fine radio station at www.khoifm.org. You can go to our page, the Dunalana page there. We have archives. We have recipes. Support this fine radio station. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lena Kitchen. We are talking about finding things in Iowa and not on the Iowa grocery shelves. No. Ben Hoksh is with us, and he has the wonderful knowledge to share with us about going out on the hedgerows and the swales and the riparian areas. Don't get your feet wet.
He's a real biologist.
And find this stuff. There is good food out there, and he's brought us some wonderful things. We've been talking mushrooms. We've been talking cordials.
We've been tasting it.
And mead. Oh, mead. So wonderful. I've had mead before, and like you, Donna, I've been very polite when people have had me taste their mead, and I'm, oh, my, that's nice. This is lovely.
Well, mead, I believe, predates wine.
I think so, too.
Especially in Northern Europe. I first ran into it in Brittany, where it's called Shushan, and it's an old tradition, and they make some pretty good stuff there.
Oh, nice.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Very good. Well, Ben, you brought... Well, I recognize some of these things, yeah, but you brought this big-looking cone.
Yeah.
And please identify that. Hold it up to the microphone. What is that?
So this is a shower head that you gather in the swamps.
Oh, that's it. It's like a shower head.
I've seen them in dried bouquets, too.
Yep. You go to your Hobby Lobby,
yep,
you'll see
there
kind
you
of a
go.
Black,
there you go.
Rattly little critter
hanging
out.
Yeah, I don't
out.
Think I'd eat the ones at the Hobby Lobby.
So this is American lotus. This is one of two of the lotus species that occur in the world. And this, the seed head, along with the roots and flowers and other parts of this plant, was traditionally a staple food for native people. You know, in this time of year, you can harvest the seeds and you can go dig down into the muck and pull what you call little mud bananas out from underneath.
Is that the root of it?
It is the root,
is
the
edible.
Tuber, yes. So this time of year, they're kind of a mix between a water chestnut and a potato. And if you cut them down, you know, like
they
the
taste
length,
a lot better than an acorn, let me tell
they're
you.
They're really good. Hey, acorns are great. You just have to leach them properly, tell
exactly.
you what.
Exactly. They're a piece of work.
They are. The lotus are super.
If you age them for a year or two, roast them, and then grind them and then leach them.
Okay.
Oh, you still have to leach them.
Yeah,
after.
You have to get the tannins out.
Oh, there are some really cool methods too that folks in California use. Where they would dig pits along the sides of rivers, and they would
just leave them in the water.
Fill them with pits, and they're still finding these today, hundreds of years old, and just slow leach by the
river
themselves.
Well, and it's the California native oak is a little different than our oak here, but
well, yeah, they are. But you know, oaks are one of those things that you know predates agriculture. You know, it's argued that this tree could have been, you know, the mm-hmm. bread of the earth, you know, that allowed people to actually discover agriculture because they were hanging out in areas for longer periods of time. You know, you could get a whole year's worth of food if you were really careful enough.
Ha, very good.
But back to the lotus here.
Back to lotus.
I'm heading down to southern Iowa today to a piece of ground, and we're going to go dig mud bananas. So that includes finding your lotus, which is a lily pad of sorts. But the difference between our lily pads that we have in Iowa and the lotus is that the lily pads will hold their leaves above the water. So they'll be suspended on a stalk. And you'll also see these little shower head seeds if they did set fruit well that year. The lily pads are always floating on the surface of the water. They'll never be suspended on a stalk. So that's a good way. I've heard stories about there's a population out at the Amana colonies that people really like to go see. And that one being a...
Oh, I've seen that big lake full of...
Yeah. So
that's this?
That is this one, yeah.
Oh.
So that is a place that natives actually brought the seeds or the roots from the river
and cultivated it,
you know. So like these things that I'm picking as like your wild plums, your nanny berries, you know, your black raspberries, these are things today that we usually just encounter in old fields or swales or fence rows or bike paths are a great place to find some of these stuff. These are things that people would harvest, they would bring back to their homes.
And then they would cultivate them, right?
They would plant them near where they had camps. And yeah, you know, and it's basically nature's garden, you know. You encourage the things you want to be around and you discourage the things you don't. And you can end up with quite the wild permaculture landscape if you just do a little work.
The thing that I just ate.
Yes.
You open up the shower-heady thing and there's little round green things about the size of a peanut M&M, right?
Yeah, peanut M&M, small acorn, you know.
And then you bite that in half, and inside that, you don't eat the whole thing. There's another kernel in there.
Yep, and inside of that little kernel, there's a little green shoot, and that green shoot is going to be the leaves of the lotus.
Little green shoot, I have to tell you, is bitter. If you take that off, the seedy thing that's left.
Yep. They are very, very nice.
It's like chestnutty.
Nice.
Kind of.
So these are pretty cool, too. If you get them when the seeds are green
delicious.
Like this, you can cut the head off, and you can put the whole shower head, the whole seed head, on the coals of a fire and let them sit for like 5 or 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And they just roast right in those shells, and they are just the nicest thing to have when you're sitting around a campfire on the Mississippi.
Now, they're delicious. How wonderful. Like you said, one sees this sort of thing at Hobby Lobby as a dried arrangement, but I'm glad to know that there is something much more useful that you can do with it.
And another cool thing about the lotus is that, you know, these seeds that are big and green now, they're going to dry down to be tiny little – it's almost like a piece of gravel. They're super hard. They're very dark, and you would never crack one with your teeth. You would need a hammer to even get anywhere close to it.
So if you were an ancient person harvesting these,
yep,
you would take them out now and get that kernel out before it gets all hard and then dry that?
I imagine you could. If you dried them well enough, I bet they would preserve pretty well.
Grind them like the way they do acorn into flour?
What I've done with these is I have a Dave-built nutcracker. They're made in California. They'll do acorns. They'll do filberts. They'll do lotus nuts.
Is it like a vice thing or what is it?
So it's kind of got like a flywheel, like a plate with like some little notches on it, and you can pull some washers in and out, and you can set the depth for the size of your nut. You bolt it onto on your desk, and then you just start cranking away. Wear some earplugs because it's loud, but it really goes through them. Lotus are pretty hard.
It's called a what?
A Dave-built nutcracker. They are a spectacular.
D-A-V-E-B-I-L-T?
I think, or B-U-I-L-T, but maybe B-I. Yeah.
Okay, Google it up.
There's probably a year-long waiting list to get one delivered to you. They're hand-built by a fella out there, but they are just spectacular.
Dave, all right. Okay.
And those lotus seeds are really cool. So this kind of they're one of the longest lived seeds on the planet. So the life cycle of these guys is, let's say you've got a lotus plant growing in the backwaters of the Mississippi. You know, it's mucky, it's shallow, it's 3 foot. There's cattails.
It does look a little primordial.
Red-winged blackbirds all around, and you get a really good crop of lotus nuts that year, and they fall to the ground. And they kind of settle down into the mud. And let's say you get a really big flood that next spring. You get an island just upstream of it that gets completely destroyed by the flood. And it totally covers up this lotus bed. All of the seeds get stuck underneath 3 foot of mud and dirt. And after 20 years, you get cottonwood trees that start to grow. And you get grasses growing on the banks and poison ivy, which loves Mississippi River islands. And that can go on for 100, 200, 300, 400 years until the next big flood comes through, wipes out that island, spills all those seeds back into the river, and they can germinate again. Over 1,000 years they can live.
Oh, how wonderful.
Mother Nature bats last. All right. That is a great story. I mean, I'm sort of imagining before Iowa was completely tiled and we had lots of low, swampy areas and so these things must have been all over the place.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with their range across the central part of Iowa. I encounter them very rarely in the wetlands and swamps around here. The one I mostly encounter is what you call duck potato or wapato or arrowhead, genus Sagittarius. They've got like these nice arrowhead-shaped leaves, and the leaves are really cool. They taste like grapefruit if you want to eat one of the young ones. But they've got nice little tubers down below you can dig this time of year as well. And they're definitely a lot more common in this region.
Okay, so what does the tuber of this lotus taste, the one you're going digging for?
So it's kind of a mixture between a water chestnut and a potato.
Does it taste kind of like the seed does?
Yeah, kind of. You know, it tastes kind of like a lotus. I'm not too good at the descriptions of some of this stuff yet. I'll have to bring some in for you the next time town. But what I really like to do with them is
I want to taste the grapefruit leaf.
Oh, yeah. There's probably some a mile or two from here we could find. But the lotus, when the tubers are immature and they haven't hearted off for the winter yet, you can just cut them and they look like little pinwheels. They're amazingly beautiful. They've got little air chambers in there so their roots can do gas exchange.
You know, in Chinese and macrobiotic, you get lotus root frozen at the end. That's what they look like.
Yep. So this is the American
version.
And so you can eat those just fresh. They're really nice to just snack on. And as they get more mature, they get a little more fibrous. So I like to take the mature ones, peel them, and then you can use a cheese grater. And you can turn them into hash brown consistency and fry them up. And the cool thing about lotus is it's white when you first encounter it. But when you cook it, it turns purple or pink. So they're very pleasing to thy purple hash browns.
We used to throw them like in miso soup.
Yeah.
Because the shape of it is quite pretty in a soup.
Oh,
and
lovely.
I've forgotten what the nutritional advantage of them are. But there's something that's good for you.
You know,
them.
I don't think as much about nutrition when I think of this stuff. You know, I think of it as adding a great amount of diversity to my diet. You know, if I'm eating as many different things as I can.
You are the variety is the spice of life.
No doubt.
Very good. And you certainly shared things with us today. My goodness, you told us about lotus and nanny berries and meads and butterflies and mushrooms and cordials. Oh, we had so many good tastes here today. So What are you going to be doing this fall? All this stuff kind of winter comes to Iowa. What are you planning on doing?
Yeah, so I took a summer job over there at Camp Dodge, and that's going to be wrapping up with the monarch migration. You know, this is the generation that's peeling south. So I think in the same vein, I'm going to be peeling south too. I got a bachelor party. I'm going to be flying to Georgia. We're whitewater rafting in West Virginia. And I'm going to hitchhike across the southern United States.
I hope you're not doing that for a couple of days.
The rafting?
Well, it could be the wild rafting right now. You know, you had a hurricane going
over
there.
Oh, they're doing a big water release on the gorge, and it's going to be class 5. It's going to be spectacular.
Whoa. You got a helmet, young man?
We'll be wearing proper protective equipment.
Okay.
Our PPE will be in the boat.
Because the rain levels are going to be unbelievable there.
I'm excited. And I bet the guides will be too.
All right. Just FYI, you guys can all now tell that this young man is about 30 years old. It's the age for this sort of thing. Bravo. Go for it.
Where else you going?
So after that, I'm going to hitchhike out of Georgia, and I'm going to cover the southern United States. So I'm going to go to New Orleans and see a friend. I'm going to hitchhike across Texas and go to New Mexico and see my mom at her new house down there.
She's in New Mexico.
She is, yep.
Iowa lady moves to New Mexico.
Yep.
Okay.
And I'm going to head up the California coast, and then I think I'm going to go to Madagascar.
From California to Madagascar. Okay.
Well, how wonderful. How wonderful.
I want to go catch a chameleon. You know, why not?
Oh, how wonderful.
A Madagascarian chameleon.
Yes.
Right?
Well, the country contains 96% of the world's chameleons. So,
whoa.
You know, it's quite the diverse place for a botanist or reptile nerd to hang out.
Oh, thank you for sharing all your stuff with us today. We've been talking with Ben Hosh. He is a botanist, a biology guy, and boy, did he ever bring some good things to talk about. Thank you for being with us today, Ben.
And thank you for pursuing this arcane knowledge that we are losing. It is very important.
Very important.
It only takes one generation to forget about
something.
That's
right. That's right. So, and I'm glad that your generation has got a reservoir of this knowledge still.
Good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks to Ben for joining us today. We've had music by the Irish band Solas. Solas, very good stuff. We'll go out with a bunch of tunes, starting out with Jimmy Clifford going into the Return Home. You can find out more about this Donna Lana Kitchen and find out more about this radio station at khoifm.org. This is a local treasure. Community radio is a local treasure. Support this radio station. Donate. And you can find
us. And listen.
And listen. You can find us here every Tuesday at noon. And we're repeated Tuesday at 7 p.m. or anytime on the web. Put us on your device. Share us with friends.
Yeah, pretend we're like a podcast.
Pretend. Yeah, we are. We enjoy coming to you. My name is Lana Nottigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Cynthia McClurg. And thank you for being with us today, Cynthia. Eat good food and enjoy life.